This is Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith.
These days, you and I face situations we've never encountered before. It's climate change, terrorism, a new disease, or maybe even an economic crash. But humans and their governments can act on experience, not the future. As our next guest can tell us, responses based on the past can fail badly. Catherine Miles has an exciting new book out about Hurricane Sandy. That's the monster storm that flooded New York City and wrecked much of New England's shore in late October 2012. Miles tells the gripping tale in Superstorm, 9 days inside Hurricane Sandy. But I think the storm and the book are also a lens for looking at preparedness during a time of climate disruption. Catherine has written several books. She's a science writer published in Outside Magazine, Popular Mechanics, and many other periodicals. Miles is currently writer in residence at Green Mountain College in Vermont. Catherine, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
It's a pleasure. Now, was Hurricane Sandy the largest storm ever seen just in the North Atlantic or the largest storm seen anywhere in modern times?
The largest hurricane in the North Atlantic. And I can't confirm it, but I believe that also makes it the largest storm on record.
And how big was it?
At the height of the storm, it was over 1,000 miles in diameter. And so, it was covering an area that was larger than Europe. And the damage that it left was larger than a couple of Europe. So immense in terms of its reach.
And before this giant arrived in America, it swept across the Caribbean. What happened there?
Well, it began as a very traditional hurricane in the southern Caribbean and did a fair amount of damage in Jamaica. Haiti in particular was very hard hit. Cuba was where it was its strongest. But, for all the damage it did in those places, it was behaving as a hurricane, and it was behaving in ways that both emergency managers and meteorologists knew how to handle. It was when it crossed over the Bahamas and began to transition into this hybrid storm that it became really problematic for everyone involved.
Well, sure, we all think we know the storm pattern from the TV news of the past. A hurricane boils up from the Caribbean, it hits or misses the south, whether it's Florida or the Gulf states, and then it gets blown by the winds or the Earth's rotation out to the Atlantic. How and why did Sandy get turned back on New England?
There were several things that were sort of weather miracles, if you will, that shouldn't have happened that led to that. Storms, particularly the hurricanes of these nature, they're really powerful, but they don't have a lot of propulsive power of their own. One meteorologist who I spoke to likened them to logs or twigs that are moving on a really sort of rapidly moving river or stream. And so they get caught up in these currents and they go where the currents go. There's a blocking high pressure system that sits over the Bahamas and up around Bermuda. Usually that blocking high works almost as a pinball effect. A hurricane will hit it and bounce off and head into the North Atlantic. This particular year, that high pressure system was not located there. And so it gave the storm really easy egress to move up. And as it did, it was caught by the Gulf Stream. And again, in 2012, the Gulf Stream was behaving in a way that is really unusual. It usually flows pretty typically from west to east. And in this particular case, it was making these really wonky kind of undulating patterns. And so it happened to be the case that it was undulating to the north, right where Sandy caught it. And then a very unusual high-pressure system was sitting over Greenland, and that's what caused it, to kind of pinball into Manhattan. So it was the impossible scenario made possible.
I imagine you must ask yourself whether climate change was involved in such an unusual storm. We'll be talking more about that, but in general, what did you conclude?
This is an unusually, and for me, very surprisingly contentious issue in meteorological circles. I was really unprepared for the level of debate and sometimes vitriol among meteorologists about climate change. What we do know for a fact is that hurricanes derive their energy from warm water, and the oceans are getting warmer. They were exceptionally warm in 2012, so that's part of what drove Sandy's ferocious power. We also know that climate change is responsible for sea level rise. The larger that we get in terms of that sea level rise happening, what happens as a result is then surge becomes exponentially greater. So places that were never before at risk of storm surge damage are now very much at risk. So those are two undeniable facts. The rest is very much a debate among meteorologists, which is interesting to me because it's not among climatologists.
Oh, we could spend a long time talking about the division between those two communities, although the American Meteorological Society just came out with a report saying that definitely climate change is human-induced and it's here. Now, I want to ask you, you spend some time in your book on the failed social responses on several levels, and I'd like to start, and remember, we have quite a few international listeners as well. Can you explain the different government weather services that come into play when a hurricane is spotted?
Every country in the area where hurricanes or typhoons can hit has its own tropical storm forecasting system. Met Cuba is a fantastic program. We rely on them a lot for data and information. Cuba was one of the early sort of experts in hurricane science, and they remain a real leader. So there's a very sort of congenial relationship between these different countries and how they interact. The people at the National Hurricane Center, the forecasters there, are regularly on the phone with other countries. Sometimes it's to get information, sometimes it's to give information. We're in something of a weather satellite crisis right now in terms of our ability to forecast. Several key instruments that our meteorologists use are either broken or nearing the end of their lifespan. So they've started to branch off into other countries to derive information from people like the European Union, India, Canada as well, too. So very much a collaborative effort, both for good and for bad, I think.
And unbelievably, by official policy, the National Hurricane Center seems to have been stuck on the label given to a storm. Why did they back off on Sandy, and what did that mean for judgments made by local authorities?
The National Hurricane Center is sort of hemmed in by the definitions that are handed to it by the National Weather Service and NOAA. And in this particular case, at the time of Sandy, they were operating under a very strict definition and protocol. And that was that the National Hurricane Center forecasts tropical storms and only tropical storms. Sandy transitioned into a hybrid storm. It became part nor'easter, part tropical storm. And so it gained a new definition. The technical word for what Sandy was is what's called an extropical system. Once it became that, the National Hurricane Center quite literally could not issue watches, warnings, and advisories. What they told me was they thought that if they tried, they could literally break their software.
Catherine Miles, please take a few minutes to explain the different responses by New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg and New Jersey Governor Chris Christie. I think there's some important lessons to be learned there.
This is a fascinating study. In New Jersey, what we saw was very decisive action by Governor Christie. He was being fed information by both the National Hurricane Center initially and then his local forecasting office. He took that information and very quickly started to make a series of very strong statements. He's a politician who's really sort of defined himself by speaking in these sort of colloquialisms. And so he would stand on up in TV and he would say things like, look, don't be stupid, get out, get off the beach, get the hell off the beach in some cases. And, you know, some people kind of poke fun at him for that, but it worked. The message really got to New Jerseyans very clearly. And about 72 to 96 hours before Superstorm Sandy made landfall in New Jersey, he made the decision to call for initially voluntary evacuations, and then very quickly he made mandatory evacuation notices. What social scientists tell us is that citizens need up to 72 hours to really internalize that information and act. If you tell someone you need to get out today, people are not inclined to get out. They need 3 days of repeated warnings to really believe that the threat is real. And that's what Governor Christie gave them. And so we saw fairly good evacuation rates in those areas. Mayor Bloomberg, who had called for massive evacuations the year before during Hurricane Irene, had actually come under a fair amount of criticism for his decision to evacuate during Irene, which famously did next to no damage on the coast, but in fact flooded and did a lot of damage to inland areas, places like upstate New York and Vermont. So those people who had left during Hurricane Irene only to find themselves trapped by inland flooding and then returned home to find their houses looted thought this is kind of one of those fool me once, shame on me, fool me twice, shame on you situations. And so they were already a tough sell in terms of getting out. Mayor Bloomberg's office, and I spoke extensively both to his staff and also to people at upper levels of his New York City Office of Emergency Management. They all said the same thing, which is, look, we felt like we were operating in the fog of war. We had drilled. We thought we were going to be getting information like surge data from the National Hurricane Center, but all of a sudden, we were getting it from this regional National Weather Service office. We were confused. We didn't feel confident about it. We saw the numbers and we thought, this is going to be another Irene. They were, of course, catastrophically wrong. But Mayor Bloomberg, about 48 hours before the storm hit, Mayor Bloomberg took to the airwaves and staged this sort of bizarre press conference where he told New Yorkers it was going to be fine, that city employees should report to work, that all they needed to do was maybe weigh down their garbage cans with a brick or something. And so he sent this sort of sense of calm among New Yorkers that was very confusing for them, because they could see that Governor Christie, that the governor of Connecticut, Delaware were issuing evacuations, but here we had this very well-respected mayor of New York saying everything's going to be fine. Of course, it wasn't. When he made that press conference, people in the meteorological world sort of instantly jumped to red alert. Lots of phone calls, lots of flurries of calls and texts and information as everyone tried to persuade him that he had made this terrible mistake. And in this really sort of harrowing 12 hours where everyone is up all night trying to persuade New York that they've made a mistake, a lot of confused information was being sent around. So by the time he did issue evacuation orders, New Yorkers had fewer than 8 hours to get out of the city before mass transit was closed. New Yorkers with functional needs and disabilities had fewer than 6 hours to get out before their transportation was canceled. So we saw some people trying to get out who quite literally couldn't. They were trapped, and some of them died.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Catherine Miles, author of Superstorm, 9 days Inside Hurricane Sandy. Catherine, let's talk about the role in media in this. How did the mainstream media handle this story?
This is a really sort of complex issue, and a lot of people point to the role of the media as a real player in terms of the confusion and the lack of evacuation and proper response. In multiple countries, places like Japan, places like Canada, places like England, their national weather system is directly tied to a national broadcasting system. So in those countries, what happens is the meteorologists, the federal meteorologists, make a warning, make a forecast. It's delivered directly to the nightly news or whoever the case may be, the radio, and it's delivered verbatim. So there's this direct line of communication. In the United States, our National Weather Service is kind of like the sort of classic statue of justice, where she's standing there blindfolded and holding out her hands. And that's kind of how our meteorologists operate. They hold out these forecasts, hoping that people will take them, interpret them correctly, and relay them. But what we're seeing is this real sort of democratization of the media, where all of a sudden, lots of people have access to weather data. Some people choose to use the National Weather Service data. We also have companies like AccuWeather, the Weather Channel, who are doing their own forecasting, in some cases completely independent of the National Weather Service. And then we have local meteorologists as well, too. And so there's some of these meteorologists choose to report that what the National Weather Service says verbatim. Some choose to interpret it. And some choose to go completely on their own and come up with their own forecast. So we see a lot of misinformation. We also know that nothing sells news more like natural disaster. So we see, unfortunately, some media channels choosing to really sort of hype and overhype storms. And I think some people start to develop a kind of tolerance to that hype. And so it's kind of a big bad wolf scenario.
So many of our listeners do worry we're living in a time of decline. What did you find out about the state of America's front lines on weather forecasting, so important in an era of climate disruption?
This was the surprise for me in researching this book, and it's very much become my focus since writing it. What I uncovered through my research was nothing short of a meteorological infrastructure crisis in this country. NOAA has been consistently underfunded since its inception in 1970, and it was placed in the Department of Commerce, which is not a logical fit for it. So for years, for decades, we've underfunded NOAA, and what was once one of the best meteorological programs in the entire world has really fallen on tough times. We have hundreds of staff shortages and openings for top-level forecasters and technicians. Again, I mentioned earlier this outmoded and broken equipment. So while we still have some of the best and most highly trained meteorologists in the world, they're hemmed in by staffing crises. They're hemmed in by the technology that's available to them. They're hemmed in by the sort of bureaucratic rules that don't let the National Hurricane Center forecast certain storms. And so really it is a crisis. It's an infrastructure crisis as much as the electric grid or bridges or anything else are. And as we saw with the recent hacks, the computer hacks of NOAA, it's also a national security crisis.
Wow. And you're right about the flaw in judging risk based on everything being okay in the past. That really caught my attention. Please tell us how that played out with Robin Waldrich, the captain of the sailing ship, the Bounty.
In a lot of ways, Robin Waldrich was a metaphor for how all of us deal with risk. And here he was this captain of a wooden vessel. It was built for the 1962 movie Mutiny on the Bounty. He made the catastrophic decision to sail into the storm. He had sailed through several other hurricanes and been successful. He assumed he could be successful in this one. He was getting misinformation from his onshore manager, who was misinterpreting the forecasts. So while a lot of people have seen him as a rogue captain, I see him more as emblematic of the decisions we all make. You know, 70% of people who were told to evacuate in the storm didn't, and it was a kind of hubris. They assumed they would be safe. Captain Waldrich assumed he would be. So did Mayor Bloomberg. And so I really wanted to call attention to the decisions that we all make about risk, because as I think you alluded to, everything we knew about weather is changing. And so using old models or what happened in the past just doesn't work for us anymore for any meteorological disaster. And it's really beholden on us to accept that and change our sense of risk.
Now, you talked about the storm surge. Was that a gradual ocean rising over a period of a day or two, or was it a stunning arrival? What did it look like?
It was a stunning arrival, and the people that I talked to said, look, you can't even make a horror movie that would describe what this was. It was literally walls of water. One second, something would be dry, and another second, it was overtaking entire cars. And so, again, here's a case where we collectively, as a culture, have underestimated storm surge. The U.S. has only one storm surge expert working for the entire country. Storm surge used to be thought of as this sort of gradual rising because we're used to storm surge happening in places like the Gulf of Mexico, where there are not dramatic tides, there are not dramatic sea level changes. And so surge is a very different beast there than it is in places like the Eastern Seaboard, or as we saw in the Philippines with the recent typhoon. Again, very dramatic surge. We're not used to seeing it in these places, so we don't really know how to deal with it. But what we do know is that historically, surge kills exponentially more people than wind. And really, that's the danger in a tropical storm.
Yeah, these storm surges are really the early warning system of rising seas due to a hotter ocean and melting glaciers. And it worries me what we talked about earlier, that some weather specialists are actually climate deniers and others are not, of course. But we have to count on these people to realize that this is the start of a new era of terrible storms, as climate scientists are warning us, due to climate change. How do you see this playing out? Will Hurricane Sandy bring about more of a change in that direction?
I hope so. It's remarkable because, the angry letters that I've gotten from this book have all been from climate change denying meteorologists, which is not anything I expected. But what we do know for a fact is that the climate is changing. We know this. We know that sea levels are rising. We know that the seas are getting warmer. And we know that this affects storms. Meteorologists may still be debating exactly how it affects them. But what I've heard from multiple meteorologists is, look, this idea of the storm of the century, you have to get rid of it. It might have been the storm of the century a couple centuries ago, but we're in a new era, and we're in an era where these storms are going to keep happening and where they're going to happen in places we don't expect. We're going to see typhoons in Hawaii. We're going to see superstorms hitting Alaska. We're going to see storms increasingly hitting places like New England. And until we adjust and until we sort of accept that this is an unknown, we are all at risk of weather.
So given what we know about the weakness in official systems, what would you advise people to do when the media starts to warn us of an extreme weather event?
I think we really have to take it seriously. I think we have to make sure that we keep ourselves and our loved ones safe. And I frankly think we also need to do a lot more well before we get to the point of a warning being issued. We have chosen to really invest in recovery, disaster recovery, but we have really underinvested in disaster preventativeness. So we need to ask some really hard questions about development patterns, about where we're building our homes, about whether we should rebuild, whether we're willing to invest in things like surge barriers, whether we've really invested in the meteorological systems that will allow us to have 5-7 days to prepare for these storms. We haven't done that. I think it's time to really commit to that.
Those are tall marching orders, but I agree with you totally. We've been talking with Catherine Miles, author of Superstorm, 9 Days Inside Hurricane Sandy. Aside from the big picture and personal advice, it's a terrific drama in the book, wound around a series of personalities well drawn by the author, I think. Find more links for this story in my weekly Radio EcoShock blog at ecoshock.info. Catherine Miles, thank you so much for the book and for talking with us.
My pleasure. I was so glad to be here.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock. Was Hurricane Sandy a freak once-in-a-century storm? Or can we expect more and worse as planet Earth heats up? What about Asia and the Pacific, where Japan was raked by a series of tropical cyclones this fall? A giant storm just battered the Philippines, again? Are those climate-related? We are lucky to have an extreme weather specialist and atmosphere scientist here to help, Columbia University Professor Adam Sobel, just published his new book, Storm Surge, Hurricane Sandy, Our Changing Climate and Extreme Weather of the Past and Future. Adam, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I appreciate you showing up for this. This is an important subject. Now, you just returned from South Korea from an invitation-only conference on tropical cyclones. What can you tell us about that?
Right. The conference is called the International Workshop on Tropical Cyclones. It happens every 4 years, and it's organized by the World Meteorological Organization, which is an outgrowth of the UN. And it's a meeting where tropical cyclone forecasters and researchers get together to discuss the advances in the science in the last 4 years and in both research and in forecast practice and try to set the agenda for the next 4 years. So it's a meeting of people from all over the world, and you get from it a good sense of what's happening in the field of tropical cyclones.
Now, at this Korean conference, was there an agreement that climate heating and rising seas are playing a role, or do some meteorological experts continue to put down the role of climate change?
It's interesting. This meeting, I haven't been to it before, but I've read the proceedings from the previous ones and know many people who've attended it. And first of all, it's important to say that a lot of the meeting is not about climate change at all, but it's just about the details of how tropical cyclones work and how they're forecast on the short time scale. But a significant portion of it is about climate, both sort of longer-term forecasting out to a season and then what climate change will do. And I was actually in charge of putting together the chapter of the report that comes out of the meeting on that with a number of other people. And I think in the past few versions of this meeting, climate change has been quite a contentious topic. There's been a lot of growth in the last 10 years in people studying the field of climate change and hurricanes since really about Katrina. There was sort of an explosion in the field. And I think it's become a little less contentious now. It's not that everyone agrees about everything, but I think it's become clearer what we know and what we don't know and what the boundaries of our knowledge are. So I think most people agree that as the climate warms, we expect tropical cyclones to get stronger on average. And so the most extreme ones will probably become more extreme. And so something like Haiyan that happened last year in the Philippines, which was the most extreme cyclone arguably ever to make landfall in known meteorological history, events like that, although they'll remain rare, will become less rare, and that's quite frightening. And I think there's more or less agreement on that. There's agreement more or less that the rainfall associated with tropical cyclones will become more intense on average. And so this event, Hagupit, that made landfall in the Philippines, that turned out not to be such an intense storm, but the threat from that one seems to be mostly rainfall-driven flooding. And events like that may become more extreme as well. I think it's also clear that the latest models are tending to indicate that there will be fewer tropical cyclones in the future. And that's a result that I think we don't understand as well. The intensification and the rainfall is not only something that models do, but something that we understand why the models do that, and we can say something about the physics of that. Whereas the decreasing frequency is something that most models are telling us, and we have some ideas why, but it's not as clear. So fewer storms, more intense, more rainfall, those are sort of the outlines of what we think we know and how well we know it. There's some uncertainty on all of those predictions, and especially as you look to individual regions, it becomes more uncertain because those are all global predictions that I just made. And the final thing I think that we more or less agree on is that we can't quite detect these changes clearly in the current climate. It doesn't mean they're not happening, but there's so much natural variability from year to year and even decade to decade that any slow trends that are there due to climate are hard to see clearly. So when we ask, is a particular storm due to climate change, those kinds of statements are very hard to defend, even though climate change may well be increasing our risk year to year, but it's doing so slowly enough that on top of the natural variability, it's hard to detect it.
Yeah, when it comes to the North Atlantic, I remember back in 2006 when New England scientist Emmanuel Carey produced papers saying hurricanes would be more frequent due to climate change. Then he sort of backtracked, and it seems to me they haven't been more frequent since the year 2000 compared to the late 1900s. What is the record on Atlantic hurricanes?
Right. So the Atlantic hurricanes have oscillated over the years with at many frequencies, but including on multi-decadal timescales. So you're right. I mean, we were in an active period for a while. The 50s and 60s were quite active, and then it was quiet for a couple decades, and then it picked up again. The last 10 years, since Katrina, really, have been quiet. There hasn't been a major hurricane, meaning a Category 3 or above, making landfall in the last 9 years, which is probably a random occurrence. Landfalls of major hurricanes in the U.S. are always rare and chancy, and so they come and go, and I don't think we can assign it to climate change one way or the other, but it is a notable drought. Yeah, Emmanuel and a couple of other papers pointed out big increases in the Atlantic over about a period from about the 70s to the mid-2000s. That sparked a lot of debate over whether that was a climate change signal. I think most of us now think that there may have been some climate change in there, but a lot of it appears to have been due to the relative warming of the Atlantic relative to other oceans. Hurricanes care more about not how warm the planet is. That matters somewhat, but what matters even more is how warm the given patch of ocean they're in is relative to the rest of the ocean. So the Atlantic went through a period of relative warming, though that may not be the whole explanation. That seems to have been part of what was happening in the period leading up to that 2006 paper.
So let's get to your book, Storm Surge. I guess the title implies you think our focus on Sandy should be the storm surge. What is that really, and what happened when the ocean invaded Manhattan and the boroughs?
Right. Storm surge is a phenomenon when the wind of a storm pushes on the ocean and moves it onto the land. It's really similar in some ways to a tsunami, although the cause is, of course, completely different. Tsunamis are caused from earthquakes at the bottom of the ocean, and storm surges are caused by wind. But it's really a very, very large, slow-moving wave, or in some cases not so slow-moving, but a wave that just sloshes the water up onto the land. And it was quite severe in Sandy because although by its peak winds, Sandy wasn't that powerful a storm. It had the winds of a Category 1 hurricane. But because it was so large and because it was coming into shore at a particularly bad angle, it pushed the water strongly into New York Harbor. And New York Harbor is shaped kind of like a triangle with a point where the city is, and the water got squeezed in and pushed up onto the land. And quite a lot of the city and the surrounding regions as well, in New Jersey, Long Island, are quite low-lying. There's a lot of our infrastructure and our neighborhoods that were built on land that prehistorically was either wetland or barrier island, which is basically glorified sand dunes, or landfill. I mean, land that was water before Columbus's time that was put in by the Dutch and English colonists. And so all of those areas were historically and still are quite close to the water and close to flooding, and those are the regions that all flooded, and some of it had critical infrastructure like power substations and transit tunnels that filled up with water, and so the city was, and the surrounding areas were just very vulnerable, is what we learned.
A guest, Professor J. Court Stevenson from the University of Maryland, suggested New York City could build tide gates at the three main entrances to the harbor for about $10 billion. And considering the damage from Sandy alone was four times that, it didn't sound impossible. What have you seen and heard about New York City's plans to protect itself against the next superstorm?
Right. So the tide gate idea is something that's been around for a while, since well before Sandy. And for a little bit, Sandy put some new energy into those who were proposing that. The city made a plan in the last days of the Bloomberg administration, which did not include tide gates, but included many other smaller scale measures. You know, the argument for tide gates is that they seem to solve the problem completely, but it's not clear that they really do. I mean, first of all, $10 billion I think is a little bit at the low end of the numbers that I've heard and it would probably take a couple of decades to do all the studies necessary to actually do the work. In the meanwhile, sea level will be rising, and the argument, one of the arguments against tide gates, besides that they're quite expensive and that they don't protect everyone, but only those inside them, and it can even make the flooding a little worse for those outside them, potentially. But I think the other argument against them is that eventually there'll be sea level rise will make them obsolete, and in the meantime, people may become complacent if they think that the problem's been solved by tide gates. I myself am somewhat agnostic about it. I'm not an engineer, and I think, you know, these cost-benefit decisions are complex, and the studies really would need to be done to evaluate them. But at the time being, it seems to be moot because the city's not proposing to do it, and it's not going to happen without that. So in the meantime, we're doing a lot of other smaller scale measures, and the new mayor administration seems to be following up on what Bloomberg's group had proposed and implementing a lot of other measures to insulate critical infrastructure and housing, and even to a very limited extent, moving people out of the most vulnerable areas, which is something we probably should consider more as time goes on.
How much has sea level gone up around New York City in the past 100 years, and what's being predicted, say, for 2050 or 2100?
Yeah, this is the most important part of the story, I think, when we want to connect Sandy to climate change. The sea level in the last 100 years here has risen around a foot, of which roughly two-thirds of that is due to the warming climate, which both makes the water swell up that's already in the ocean and also adds more water to it as ice on land melts. The other third is natural and is due to the subsidence of the land in recovery from the last ice age. So that's about a foot, of which the better part is due to climate, and that added to Sandy's 9-foot storm surge to make the damage worse. So I think if you want to find a climate change contribution to Sandy, that's the most important one. And if we look to the future, the sea level predictions are uncertain quantitatively, but certain qualitatively. In other words, we know that the sea level is rising and that that will increase our risk of future flooding disasters, apart from any changes in hurricanes that might happen. And in fact, the sea level rise is quite more certain than the changes in hurricanes are. So the projections in the most recent IPCC report put by 2100 as much as a meter sea level rise. I think actually that's conservative and is, first of all, it's an increase in the estimate since the last IPCC report. And if you read the literature, there's estimates higher than that, even as high as 2 meters. So several feet by the end of the 21st century is quite possible. So if you think about Sandy had a 9-foot surge on top of a 5-foot tide, 3 feet or even more than that of sea level rise is really quite a big change and will make it such that absent any major changes in our infrastructure to deal with that higher water, it'll take a much weaker storm to produce a flooding level that Sandy produced. And so events like that will become much more common even without any huge changes in the climatology of the storms.
Radio EcoShock.
Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Listeners, you are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Columbia University professor and atmospheric scientist Adam Sobel. So moving on beyond the storm surge, there have been a lot of guesstimates about the contribution of hotter seas, as you mentioned, off New England, plus the extra water vapor in a warmer atmosphere. What do we know about these other synergies between climate change and superstorms?
Well, superstorm, of course, is not a technical term. It was a term that was coined for Sandy because of the fact that Sandy was predicted not to be technically a hurricane at landfall, but a winter-type storm. But it was really sort of a hybrid, and so not knowing what to call it, the name superstorm was invented. But I think it's important that you use that term because it does make the point that while we do know a fair bit about hurricanes, and we talked at the beginning about how climate change will affect hurricanes, which are tropical cyclones, and so we do expect them to get more intense as a result of a warming climate, and that is partly due to the rising sea temperatures and the water vapor and the factors that you mentioned. Storms like Sandy, which are hybrid and part hurricane, part winter storm, are more typical of what we get at these higher latitudes, where a hurricane in New York and further north than that, a true pure tropical hurricane is pretty rare, and and the biggest storms of our history, such as the 1938 storm, for example, were all, if they weren't hybrids like Sandy, they were starting to go in that direction. And so I think we know even less about those than we know about normal hurricanes. So I think there's really a great deal of research to be done to understand our particular region, and even more further north in New England and Canada, and similar regions in Asia, for example, like Japan and China and Korea. We really need to do some research on how these kind of hybrid storms will respond to climate change, because we just haven't studied it much. But as far as the normal tropical storms, we do expect more intense, but perhaps fewer, and what that means is not completely clear. It depends which one is a stronger effect, but it could well mean that even though there are fewer storms, that the more intense ones do happen more often, which is quite worrying. And it's important to emphasize again that as far as coastal flooding disasters from storm surge, which is what kills the most people in many regions, is what killed the most people in Sandy, is what killed the most people in Haiyan, is storm surge. Because of the rising sea level alone, those kind of events are going to become more common, and I think that's something that's become clearer in the last few years.
And I see in your bio notes you offered a course at Columbia University called Hurricane Sandy Science Impacts Response. What do you tell your students about their developing future?
Well, in that course, we looked at all the different dimensions of Sandy, and not just the storm itself, but the city's infrastructure and insurance and beach erosion. I had many experts from many different fields. So there was no unique message, but I think what's important to understand is not just the role of climate change, which is certainly increasing many risks we face, even though we can't necessarily pin every storm on it. We nonetheless have to understand how the climate change is making us more vulnerable, but also the consequences of development decisions that are unwise and due to the fact that we develop our infrastructure and our cities and our coastlines over many years in the face of relatively rare events so that we don't necessarily think about those events. So we build in low-lying places. We put, you know, subway tunnels underground without any way to stop the water from getting in. We don't build high enough seawalls around our power generators, and it takes a big disaster to make us recognize those things. But over time, we're more and more developing in risky coastlines because people like living by the water, and so hurricane damages are going up very, very quickly over the course of the 20th century, even without any large trends in hurricanes, just because of more development. And in the developing world, that puts more lives at risk as people are living in dangerous places. And I think we need to understand that, the consequences of those decisions, just as much as we need to understand the consequences of burning carbon.
Now, what approach did you take in your book, Storm Surge? How is it organized?
The first half of the book is a set of alternating chapters where one chapter describes a day in the life of Sandy, framed in terms of forecast advisories and discussions from the National Hurricane Center in many of the chapters, and then explanation in non-specialist language of what they mean to describe what the storm was doing day by day. And those chapters are alternated with chapters of scientific background explaining different aspects of the science. Some are historical, such as about the history of weather forecasting and how the science of that developed, and history of tropical meteorology, which is really quite a fascinating subject. So that's the first half of the book. It's sort of explaining what Sandy's doing day by day, and it ends with landfall and all the decisions that had to be made leading up to landfall, and then all the damage that the storm did and the immediate aftermath. And then the second half of the book is about the larger picture, what it means for the future, and that gets into the role of climate change and development and all those broader questions that the storm raised for us here in the region and in the nation about how we think about the future now that we understand that some of our largest urban areas are quite vulnerable.
Adam, were you in New York City when Hurricane Sandy struck?
I was, yes. I was here. I was seeing it coming in the week leading up to it as the forecasts were being made, which were quite accurate. I was following it, and I was sitting in my apartment all day mostly talking to the media like this, as it was making landfall. We weren't supposed to go outside, but at the end of the day, right after landfall, I did, just to go down to the Hudson River and see the high water, because it was a historic moment. So I got a few photos of that and have my own memories of it. I was fortunate in that my neighborhood didn't flood and didn't lose power, so we were safe. But the city, of course, was paralyzed, and with its transit system not functioning and other things not working. And so I went through that along with millions of other people.
Well, it's almost like a storm 9/11 in a way for New York City, and we found out after that storm how critical New York City is to our economic system. I think it's almost a national security issue that we have this city able to operate despite storms that might come. We've been talking with Columbia professor and atmospheric scientist Adam Sobel. You can find his new book, Storm Surge, Hurricane Sandy, Our Changing Climate and Extreme Weather of the Past and Future. Anywhere books are sold, of course. I've got links to his website, the book website, a great radio interview with Adam that he did with Leonard Lopate of WNYC New York Pacifica Radio. You can find all those links in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Adam, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me, Alex.
Radio EcoShock.
Every now and then, there's a game-changing scientific paper about climate change. I saw this one and right away invited our next guest. Catherine Rickey, known as Kate, joined well-known scientist Ken Caldera to investigate a critical question. How long does it take the carbon we emit today to reach its peak heating potential? If you answered 50 years or more, you're in for a shock. The title of the new paper is a giveaway. Maximum warming occurs about one decade after a carbon dioxide emission. That was published December 2, 2014 in the journal Environmental Research Letters. The lead author is Catherine Rickey, a postdoctoral researcher at the Carnegie Institute for Science at Stanford University in California. Kate, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, your study's kind of a bombshell. We've been told for years that carbon emissions will really impact our children or our grandchildren, not us. How did you find the peak heating is only 10 years after emission?
Well, we actually used the same models and modeling results that people have been using to make the best possible projections for how the climate will change under various emission scenarios going forward. It's just that no one had ever bothered to take the results from these model ensembles before and do this analysis of what the effect of an individual emission that someone makes today is. And when we combined the results from these modeling ensembles to do this analysis, we were pretty surprised because we weren't expecting the time until the maximum effect to be just 10 years.
And I want to go into that paper further, but I guess an obvious question from a non-scientist would be, why does a puff of carbon take 10 years to become active in trapping heat radiation? Why doesn't it have its maximum impact as soon as it goes up into the atmosphere?
It's because it takes a while for the oceans to warm up. If you think about the atmosphere like a shallow frying pan with a little bit of water in it versus the ocean is a huge stock pot full of water. It just takes a while, no matter how high you turn up the burner, to get that pot of water to warm up. And that's basically why we see the lag in warming when we put carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, because the ocean can only warm up so quickly. And that's what causes the lag.
That makes sense. So in your paper, you quote former U.S. Energy Secretary Stephen Chu saying, and I'll quote that, it may take 100 years to heat up this huge thermal mass so it reaches a uniform temperature. The damage we have done today will not be seen for at least 50 years, unquote. Now, I found plenty more like that. Is this a long-running misconception? And if it is, how has it shaped climate negotiations and government responses?
There's two sides to this. I mean, what we found is that after you release a pulse of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, there's a lag in its effect, and the atmosphere warms up with a delay of about a decade. But then a lot of that warming does stick around for a really long time, for more than 100 years. And so the idea that our carbon dioxide emissions today will affect our children and our grandchildren isn't wrong. Because the effects of carbon dioxide are quite persistent. What is different is just this idea that the actions that we take will also affect us during our lifetimes. I think people are used to thinking about decisions on the order of just 10 years down the future. So what the result shows is that not only will our children and our grandchildren benefit from an avoided emission, but the person who actually avoids that emission will benefit as well.
So reading through your paper, it was a fast education on some of the hardest issues of climate change, and in particular, I'm thinking of the uncertainty faced when trying to calculate how fast CO2 can become most active. I'd like to look at those one at a time if we could, starting with the uncertain role of the carbon cycle. Could you talk to us about that?
So carbon cycle uncertainty has to do with the different sinks of carbon in the Earth system, as well as how quickly those sinks can interact with the atmosphere. So when we release carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, immediately different systems start to take up that carbon dioxide. The ocean takes up a huge chunk of it eventually. Also, the terrestrial biosphere takes up carbon dioxide. And so what the uncertainties are what's the capacity for these different systems to take up carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, and how quickly can they do that?
And then climate sensitivity, it's a huge question. I interpret that as we're not sure what level of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere will trigger things like fast glacier melting or the permafrost exhaling more CO2. Did I get that right?
So the things you mentioned are things that depend on climate sensitivity. Climate sensitivity itself is a measure we use when we're simulating the climate that indicates sort of the magnitude of the effect of a change in concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere. So technically how it's usually measured is you start with a simulation of the climate from the pre-industrial climate before we started emitting a lot of things to the atmosphere. And then you instantaneously double the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And there's no carbon cycle in these modeling simulations, so all of that carbon dioxide just stays in the atmosphere permanently. Then we wait for the oceans to warm up and for the climate to re-equilibrate, stabilize at a new temperature, and that temperature change is usually indicative of the climate sensitivity of a given climate model.
Well, we talked about the long-standing misconception that carbon going up now will take at least a generation to affect the climate. But I also, researching this, came across a school of scientific thought led by Matthews and Solomon's 2013 paper saying our past emissions do not determine future warming. And that's a tricky problem to explain. Could you help us understand what that debate is?
Well, I think that Matthews and Solomon were also trying to push back a little bit against this idea that the benefits from emissions cuts will only accrue to future generations. And so what they were showing in that perspective piece that they wrote in Science in 2013 was that the decisions we make about emissions and climate change mitigation policies this century will have effects on temperature trajectories this century. The assumption they made in that, this sort of simple analysis they did for that perspective, is that actually there's no lag between warming and emissions. And that's just a very simple assumption that they made, which is a little inconsistent with a lot of the other information you find out there, but is probably not any worse than the other types of assumptions we found that, you know, the effect is delayed by 30, 40, for 50 years. And I guess this was actually one of the papers that really motivated us when we decided to look into this question, because it's a huge contrast to this idea that there's actually a much longer lag. And so we asked ourselves, well, what is the time until the maximal effect of a carbon dioxide emission? And we said to ourselves, oh, someone must have written this paper because it's so obvious. And so we looked for the paper, and we looked and we looked, and it turned out that no one had written this paper before. So we said, oh, let's take the best data that's available right now and try and estimate what that timing is and what the uncertainty associated with it is. So this paper that you referenced definitely was one element of what led us to do this study.
Now, on the subject of time lag, and this isn't really in your paper, but it's something I'm hoping you can help me with. Following that Matthews and Solomon paper, an excellent science blogger named John Cook said bluntly, there is no warming in the pipeline. Nothing is baked in. And yet my understanding is from people like Dr. James Hansen, he talks about up to 1 degree or more in the pipeline. because of either heat stored in the oceans yet to come out or because of global dimming, that aerosol pollution that diminishes the sun hitting the Earth. Is there a warming in the pipeline beyond the 10-year lag that you found in your research?
Well, when you start talking about things like aerosols, which aren't accounted for in our analysis at all because we purely isolated the effect of carbon dioxide with this analysis, then it's definitely true that there's a huge cooling effect associated with anthropogenic aerosols in the atmosphere, and that they're counteracting the effects of greenhouse gases to a great extent right now. And while our greenhouse gas emissions are expected to continue to increase for the foreseeable future, under business as usual scenarios at least, aerosol concentrations are absolutely expected to start to peak within the next decade or so and then start to go down. And so as we see that happening in a more, you know, realistic scenario or in the real world, then absolutely a bunch of this warming that would be associated with the greenhouse gases already in the atmosphere and that has been masked by these anthropogenic aerosols reflecting sunlight back into space or creating more clouds, a lot of that warming will start to manifest itself.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Stanford scientist Catherine Rickey, talking about the paper Maximum Warming Occurs About One Decade After a Carbon Dioxide Emission. Well, Kate, in a well-written article at Climate Central, Andrew Friedman found scientists who temper your discovery for several reasons. Some say the timing doesn't matter. All that matters to the climate system is the total greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, whenever that comes. What do you think about that?
Well, I think it depends on what you care about in terms of what it means for something to be important. First of all, from an impact standpoint, there's a good case to be made that it's not the maximum effect that's the important thing, but the persistence of the warming associated with CO2. And that depends on the impact you're interested in. Some impacts do scale pretty closely with the warming effect from CO2. That's things like heat waves or extreme precipitation. And these things are significant impacts associated with climate change and can cause a lot of damage. On the other hand, there's impacts like sea level rise from melting ice sheets or ecosystem die-off. And for those types of impacts, it's the persistence of the warming effect that really makes a big difference, because probably, you know, one hot year isn't going to kill off the forest, you know, in your backyard. But 20 hot years in a row, yeah, that's probably not so good for the existing ecosystem. So it really does matter how long the warming lasts. The other point is just, I think that the 10 years does make a difference in the way that we think and we talk about climate change. Like I said, the results from our analysis are taken from the models that were used to make projections for the last IPCC report. So we haven't changed anything about the physics in this analysis. We just did the analysis such that we could isolate the effect of a single emission. And I think the difference it makes is just showing that that maximum effect occurs on a timescale that I'm thinking about. I think psychologically, the idea that something's going to happen 10 years down the road as opposed to 40 years down the road makes a big difference for a lot of people. And I think it makes a difference to people like politicians as well, because it means the people that are voting for you right now will also benefit from a potentially costly policy decision.
Well, and I think it matters to us personally, too. I mean, if I'm driving my crappy gas-guzzling car and I think, well, it's not going to affect me while I'm alive, but then I find out, oh, yeah, in 10 years, that carbon's going to come back to bite me, maybe I'll try a bike or public transit.
I think so. I think it makes a difference to me. It's made a difference to a lot of people that I've talked to about this paper. it's just a time scale that I think we're a lot more used to thinking about things on just 10 years down the road.
You know, after reading your study, I was left wondering how long a particular carbon emission can stay active in the atmosphere. I talked to this a little bit with David Archer a couple of years ago, and he's saying, well, the CO2 that you put up there, the exact molecules that you put up there won't stay there because they'll be recycled through the biosphere, but the additional level that you've added will stay there for 50,000 years, 100,000 years maybe, but your graphs appear to stop after 100 years. Was that due to the uncertainty that you had, or why did you cut it off at that point?
Yeah, we decided to cut off our analysis at 100 years just for purely practical reasons. Like I said, the idea behind the study was very much to anchor the results in what was available, the best available data from these large modeling ensembles. Some of the simulations only went for 100 years, so we decided, oh, we'll just do the analysis for as long as we have data from all our data sources. Yeah, it's well known that a significant fraction of that carbon dioxide, once you've emitted it, sticks around for a very long time. So we would expect a significant fraction of that warming to persist for hundreds of years.
Now, as we wrap up, I want to ask you a favor. If you could explain in terms for a layperson what happens to that puff of carbon dioxide that you've been studying. Let's say it comes out of the tailpipe for a car or out of our furnace or something. How long does it take to rise into the atmosphere? Does it change chemically? How high does it go? What happens to it?
So carbon dioxide doesn't chemically react very much with things in the atmosphere. That's one of the reasons it's so persistent. Unlike methane, which actually eventually becomes carbon dioxide if it hasn't precipitated out of the atmosphere, CO2 tends to stay CO2 when it's in the atmosphere. The troposphere, or the lower layer of the atmosphere that we live in, is convectively unstable, so it's very turbulent, and that's why we get a lot of weather down here near the surface of the Earth. It basically just means that it's warmer near the ground than it is higher up, and so we get a lot of mixing in the troposphere. And so, yes, CO2, when we emit it, it tends to mix up pretty quickly, which is why, since it's sticking around, why CO2 is such a global pollutant. It's not like these tropospheric aerosols that get emitted near a power plant and the majority of that pollution stays in that region. It's truly a transboundary pollutant that if I emit it here in the U.S., it's going to affect people all over the world. And so basically how CO2 exits the atmosphere is through those types of systems I was talking about earlier. Some of it gets taken up by forests and things like that and sequestered in new biomass. Some of it gets dissolved into the ocean, and that's what causes what people call ocean acidification. And over very, very, very long time scales, geologic weathering and things like that ends up eventually taking extra CO2 out of the atmosphere. But that's something that, like Dave Archer was talking about, it takes, I think, tens of thousands of years is the time scale for that.
Well, thank you so much. We've been talking with Catherine Rickey, a postdoctoral research scientist for the famous Carnegie Institute for Science at Stanford University. Her new paper is Maximum Warming Occurs About One Decade After a Carbon Dioxide Emission, published in Environmental Research Letters on December 2nd. It's a groundbreaking new look at the speed of impacts from carbon dioxide and pushing the results of pollution into our own near-term future instead of a coming generation. You can find links to all that in my Radio EcoShock show blog at ecoshock.info. Kate Rickey, it has been a pleasure learning from you. Thank you so much.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Not to be nice, I'm not.